Hello, this is Guillermo del Toro, and we are going to be together mercifully for one last time in this Night Gallery episode. And perhaps the most famous episode of the series. The episode starts with the caterpillar. I think that more has been written about this segment of Night Gallery than most any other, and rightfully so. Stephen King, in eulogizing Rod Serling's career in Dance Macabre, makes a special stop just to remark that in spite of the many flaws Night Gallery had, and in essence he views everything about the show as dreadful, in spite of that, he redeems Caterpillar as the height of the show. It is a very scary, quite memorable episode, and one that has been recounted in many schoolyards, almost like an urban legend. The episode I remember made such an impression in me that I did recount it the next day at school as if it was almost like an urban tale. You know, as is the case in many of the episodes, it is hard for me to discern what the painting is trying to express, except that it sort of encompasses the atmosphere of the episode. I don't know exactly. You know, some of the paintings by Tom Wright are so memorable and so powerful. Very pop art, many of them, but many of them rather intriguing and menacing. And some others, I imagine, under the constraints of production, are simply puzzling. In the case of that painting, that is the case. The short story the episode is based on is called Boomerang, and it was written by Oscar Cook. Cook did spend a long time, about a decade, in Borneo, in North Borneo. He was a British officer, and he was there in official duty, and he became very familiar with the language, with the customs and the myths. And the caterpillar is said to be based on sort of a tall tale of an explorer that completed a most difficult expedition with a dead bug sort of festering in his ear. As Stephen King remarks, it is not understandable why. And my wife, who is a veterinarian doctor, remarked the same when we saw the episode. Why should the passage of the earwig be so painful through the brain if the brain has no nerve endings? Perhaps that's true, but we all have felt and gone through how brutal the pain is of an ear infection. And I believe that is the element that we relate the story to. The caterpillar has benefited from one of those rarities in Night Gallery, which is a perfect cast. Everybody is at the very least adequate, if not really good or great, in the episode. And most of them are perfectly cast. The idea of this sort of rich boy, you know, the class conflict enacted, you know, an English class conflict enacted so strongly, so far away from civilization, so to speak. You know, the idea, the entitlement that the Lawrence Harvey character feels by birth, by youth, and by vigor, he feels he is entitled to Jean Appetit. I think that It is brilliant. It is brilliant in the short story, but it is more brilliant even in the Rod Serling adaptation. He shines in this teleplay, I think. I've spoken in the past about the precision and the very difficult delivery of Rod Serling's lines, which are now and then can be rather purple and rather prone to metaphors and rather prone to elaborate figures of speech, and require of a rhythm and delivery of actors that the more trained the actor, the more classically trained the actor, the better the lines get in the case of Serling. It has a particular patois, it has a rhythm and a language that is all his own. I have made a kinship with how difficult the David Mamet dialogue delivery is because of its precision and the way it's written. And in The Caterpillar, the staging is so precise, the staging of the dialogue is so precise, the delivery. And the staging of the camera work by Jan Otswark is absolutely fabulous. It's truly remarkable. You know, Jan Otswark, I think, I have no doubt, is at his best, at his most elegant in the camera work he does in this episode. I particularly love the fact that none of his camera movement, none of his camera work is flashy at all, but is discreet and many a time, often in motion. He does not resort to the academic staging of the master over, close-up, academic staging of a scene. He does rely on close-ups and to some extent, but his camera work is really elegant, beautiful, and rather precise.
Stop counting time. In a year, suddenly it'll all be over. Then you can return.
In the casting, I will start with the piece of casting that is less mentioned, I think, and that is Don Knight. Don Knight plays a wonderful low-class expatriate, a criminal, with such pathos, with such sympathy, with such soulful understanding of his position and the ways of the world, that to me he is the star of the episode. Don Knight was a stage actor, television and movie actor, that was remarkably adept at adopting dialects and accents. And I think perhaps my ear is flawed for being a Mexican, and people can tell me I am full of it, and it is not true, but his dialect and particular delivery in this teleplay is fantastic. I think he does a very well-modulated, low-class accent in his character, and it defines how his character talks.
Sorry, the only pleasure I have in this place.
It's also to Rod Serling's merit that he was able to contrast the exquisite, polite, social predatory nature of Lawrence Harvey's character with Don Knight's simple predatory nature in his character. And it is reflected in language, it is reflected in speech, but it is also greatly staged by Swark. You know, the textural nature of the clothing of the Don Knight character, the wetness, the shininess, the coarseness of his appearance in makeup, in hair, in wardrobe, and the fastidiously pristine delivery and appearance of Lawrence Harvey. You know, Joanna Petit was sort of a recurring goddess in the Knight Gallery universe. She did four episodes, including Caterpillar. She did the famous Girl with the Hungry Eyes, a favorite for many, not to me, but a favorite to many. Keep in Touch, We'll Think of Something, and The House, which is a curious episode that I have a certain fondness for.
As one of your fellow men.
She was originally born in the UK, in the in London, and She traveled a lot. She emigrated to Canada, where her mother remarried and then came back and had a career in film and in TV. She was rather famous at some point. She was a Bond, a James Bond girl. She was highly successful in California on TV. And she was also quite close to Sharon Tate, and almost stayed over in a visit the day Sharon Tate was murdered at the CeeLo Drive, famously murdered by Manson, the Manson family. I'll make a pause. You know, this is one of the few episodes where they allow themselves in Night Gallery a certain flair in the cinematography. And they do this great sort of halo light, eye light in Lawrence Harvey a couple of times in the episode. And they do have shadows being casted on the walls, and they do have a certain degree of darkness, especially important in the bar or restaurant scene between Harvey and Don. You know, there are little flares, but they are so welcome in a show that did not make itself a landmark of cinematography. At any rate, Joanna Petit was rather famous and rather a staple in the Universal TV series and in general in American TV series. And she slowly made her way into retiring from both TV and movies. I believe that she is rather a great presence, especially when she's well used, like in this episode, as a woman of both beauty and principle. She has a very strong character in the episode, and although her makeup and hair are inevitably, as it would happen in Night Gallery very often, inevitably 1970s, she does a rather great work at conveying the class and principles of sort of Victorian or proper English lady.
I'm famished. How about you, Macy? An appetite?
Slowly growing.
Excellent. I know. Let's put some candles on the table tonight. Make it a bit festive. I'll go and wash up.
Mr. Macy. I think perhaps I do you an injustice.
It is in this episode that I think most people in my generation will recall Lawrence Harvey. Lawrence Harvey had a rather curious career. You know, he was an actor that was always sort of on the verge of breaking, having a big break. A guy that was always sort of on the verge of becoming famous or becoming celebrated or becoming a star. He had a very hard life, and he was regarded as a rather hard, unrelatable actor. He had an off-putting quality, a sort of aggressive screen presence. But it serves him very well for this part. Here it is, that scene that is one of the most atmospheric scenes in the Night Gallery canon. And it's incredibly simply staged, but incredibly well staged by the actors and the director. You know, here's that wonderful light, recurring light into sort of a black and white type of lighting, almost like expressionist film lighting. But as I said, that cold stone hard quality that Lawrence Harvey had that worked against him so often worked in favor of his character here. He has also an earnestness and a precision of delivery, and his chiseled features, in the contrast with the malleable, almost clay-like features of Don Knight. It is so wonderful to observe the contrast between these two characters in this scene. Serling understands it and delivers it through the language. But observe Lawrence Harvey's rather remarkable and stony and strong presence, and the way he listens. One of the salient features of a great actor is to know how to look at other actors and how to listen. But contrast the dry, chiseled, stone-like features of Lawrence Harvey and his almost theatrical, precise Shakespearean delivery with the casual, watery, dirty, slightly greasy presence of the Don Knight character, which is hundreds of times more vulnerable and sympathetic than the Lawrence Harvey character. And arguably, this low-class character who is humiliated by procedure, by the Harvey character, by this entitled, well-to-do, rich boy from England. He takes his revenge. It's never quite clear if, in fact, at least in the teleplay, if the caterpillar, the earwig, is really put in Harvey's ear by mistake or by design. It is arguable that the character Don Knight creates may have taken the decision of simply teaching him a lesson or murdering him. And in that, it is, with that in mind, it is rather beautiful to see the upcoming scene when his character is apologetic and all quivering and fragile in apologizing for the big mistake that he made when Harvey is having one of his most intense moments of pain. It's a great scene, and it's coming right up, and I really think it's one of the most brilliant ones. Another salient aspect of the episode is the music by Eddie Sauter, you know, or Eddie Sauter, I don't know how to pronounce it. He also did the music for another remarkable episode and another remarkable piece of music, the episode Brenda in the second season. And he ended up creating the main theme for Night Gallery for the third season. The original main theme of Night Gallery was created by Gilles Mellier. And Gilles Mellier was one of the first experimental musicians to try and create complete scores with electronic music. Two of Mellier's pieces are my favorite music, childhood music pieces I can remember. The theme to Kolchak, The Night Stalker, the TV series, and obviously the theme to Night Gallery. Although I'm not as in love with Eddie Sautier's theme for the third season of Night Gallery, I urge you to listen carefully to his instrumentation and his creation of the score in Caterpillar. Is quite minimalistic and is rather remarkable in how effective it is in conveying the madness and the obsession. The percussion instruments, which sound, to the untrained ear at least, they sound regional enough to belong in this Malaysian or in the Malaysian fable that we are witnessing. Rather disturbing. They sound insect-like, much like the earwig or the caterpillar nesting in Lawrence Harvey's ear. And they also have a pulsing, propulsive energy to it, to them, that is very eminently narrative. Eddie Sauter was a famous composer and jazz musician, and he was highly regarded during the big band swing era, and worked for people as well known as Artie Shaw and Benny Goodman. And you know, he is a valuable addition to Night Gallery, since he brings an off-kilter sensibility, much like Gilles Mellet brought to the title credit music. He is one of the elements of Night Gallery that is blissfully up to date in the stories.
When this is over, I never want to see you again. You understand?
Coming back to Lawrence Harvey, I think that if you remember him from his interventions in his roles in The Manchurian Candidate, or John Schlesinger's Darling, or any of the others that you may remember him. To my generation, he will forever remain associated with this episode. And the intensity, the anger, and the pain he's able to portray in this episode may have very well come out of his biographical story. He had, as I said, a rather rough life. He was never appreciated by the critics or audiences or producers. He was occasionally bisexual, and he felt quite out of place in the world and in the world of show business. He was had a heavy drinking problem and died tragically of cancer at a young age. His daughter became famous and immortalized by Tony Scott to a degree in the movie Domino. She was a very famous bounty hunter, she became. And I think Lawrence Harvey was a much better actor, perhaps miscast as a hero often, more at home as an anti-hero or a villain. But I think he would have been a perfect Hitchcockian actor, an actor that Hitchcock would have perversely enjoyed enormously.
What's the matter, Mr. Mason?
Is your ear bleeding? Must be some sort of bug bite. It's in my ear. The damn thing is in my ear.
This revelation of how the earwig is in his ear is so brilliant and understated in the beginning, because you have the guy just having breakfast, and Janet Swark very intelligently, rather shrewdly and precisely, cuts to the ear, to the other ears, as he observes and awaits for that resolution. And casually, from the get-go, from the first moment in the scene, if you watch it again, he's scratching at his ear. He feels the earwig early in the scene, but you can only notice it on a second viewing. I think the presence of John Williams, this fabulous actor who is indeed associated with Hitchcock too. So you have associations with Vertigo, you have associations with Hitchcock, Dial M with Murder, and now with John Williams, again, you have associations with Hitchcock's TV series. Hitchcock directed John Williams several times, not only on film, but also on his TV series. And he was a very efficient, a very classical actor. I love him dearly. I love him in The Doll, as I said, my favorite episode in Night Gallery. And I have a huge fondness for him. He is the quintessential professional actor, English actor. Precise in his knowledge of the camera work, precise in his delivery, and imminently reliable and imminently likable in any of the TV or film appearances he ever did. And we come to this scene that I remarked before, where it's so wonderful. You have this completely deranged Lawrence Harvey character. And you have, on the other hand, one of those famous Rod Serling monologues, executed brilliantly by Don. You know, he goes in to give his condolences to Lawrence Harvey in this wonderful shot. And he has essentially a monologue with no one listening to him. It's a soliloquy of repentance, but a rather polite, rather meek repentance in the face of the most horrible, inhuman, excruciating pain Lawrence Harvey is going through. And the way Harvey modulates his performance, where you're never absolutely sure if he is listening or not to the monologue, because he appears to be listening and then he fades into this horrible, completely absent moments of the utmost pain. Is so intense. It is so extreme that it became really haunting as a kid. And, you know, the makeup is perfect, the staging is perfect, the lighting is perfect. I think, without a doubt, in my mind, it's Jeanette Swarg's crowning achievement as director in any medium. It is a memorable piece. It is a memorable piece by everyone involved. And in that, it does remain perhaps the most perfect episode and as such the most well-regarded of a Night Gallery. It was not often that Rod Serling favored the surprise twist endings, not in his editorial choice of the stories and not in his adaptation of the stories. I myself also dislike what could be known as the O. Henry twist ending. I don't like it at all. I think this is, if you want a twist at the end, it should not be the conclusion of a story. But now and then, it is a perfect device. And although Serling uses it very sparingly, you know, he does make good use of it. Other writers popularized that ending, notably Robert Bloch and Frederick Brown often used it, the twist ending. But rarely does it provoke as intense a horror as it does in The Caterpillar. Shock and horror. M. Night Shyamalan is famous for doing these twist endings, sometimes very effective, sometimes not so organic, it seems. But I think that the Caterpillar, Boomerang, which is also a great title, Boomerang, remains a salient example of this. And the fact that the delivery of the surprise twist ending is given to John Williams. The parsimonious, but empathic way he delivers it. The staging of the scene is impeccable. Everybody is almost bolted to the floor, except Joanna Petit, who is going to leave shortly. And you have this barely ambulatory sort of you know, shaky presence in Lawrence Harvey, who slowly creeps upon this this frozen statue-like group that regard him with completely puzzling pity, because he is essentially an attempted murderer, you know, a failed murderer. And yet his would-be victims are so full of pity for him. And the staging is perfect. It's perfectly awkward. The lighting is amazing for the gallery. Night Gallery standards is incredibly atmospheric. And the table is set. You know, the table is set for for the delivery. The brilliant staging as Lawrence Harvey slowly creeps up on them and he's asked to sit down. It's impeccable. The rhythm of Serling's writing, the staging of Jeannot Souark, the delivery of the actors, it's all in place. You know, it's all in place. And when it's finally delivered, that the earwig, the caterpillar, was a female, and that having made it through his brain, it laid eggs. It's a shocker that resonates for years and years to come. Even people that normally don't like horror films or horror shows relate to it. And in the writing of Serling, the fact that Lawrence Harvey has gone through hell, but has remained essentially unrepentant and still a prick, you know, still quite a prick, still quite agonizingly proud and remote, you know, all these things, you know, they are brilliantly contrasted with the fact that by this stage, we fully identify with everybody. And Lawrence Harvey has the dual role of villain and victim. And as such, The Caterpillar remains a remarkable piece of writing, a remarkable piece of dramaturgy. Rod Serling, as I said in the past, said many times some of the stuff he wrote in his 30-plus something years of career, most of the stuff was at best memorable, remarkable, I mean, at best ingenious, but nothing transcendent, nothing truly, truly memorable. And that may have been his opinion when Night Gallery was a contemporary experience. But when you look back into it, as I do, as a kid in awe, for whom all these things are absolute classics, I must disagree with him. I think that this episode, amongst others, it is a remarkable piece of craftsmanship and a remarkable piece of drama. And as such, it won't be forgotten. In many ways, Night Gallery is objectively a flawed TV series. But when it's firing on all cylinders, when it achieves perfect casting and it's aptly supported in production values, as is the case of The Caterpillar, which is sumptuous looking for its standards, it is as good as The Twilight Zone was, but for me particularly, in a more powerful way, because it dealt with gothic romance and horror and the darker side of the imagination in ways that are much more empathic with the way I view the world and our craft as storytellers.